So before I get into this, I'm going to do a very short history on the Pali Canon, so you know where this fits in to the whole scheme of things. The Pali Canon, as I'm sure many of you know, is the basis for Buddhism itself. It is the oldest surviving teachings of the Buddha. And the Pali Canon was saved, was created during the Buddha's lifetime and later, and was put into writing about 450 years after the Buddha's death. And then it was enshrined in Sri Lanka, where the most complete version was found. The general categories of the Pali Canon are called Pitakas, and I'm not sure how you pronounce that out loud because I only read it. I keep having this problem when I read things and then say them out loud. And Pitakas, it means basket, and there are three major baskets in the Pali Canon. And the first one is the Vinaya, which is the rules of conduct for monks and nuns. The second are the Suttas, which is what we study and what I'll be talking about tonight. And the third is the Abhidhamma, which is not considered part of the original Pali Canon because it was written so much later, and it's a commentary on the teachings themselves. So the Sutta Pitaka, which I'm going to talk about tonight, has five major divisions. The first one is the Nikayas, means books. Digha Nikaya is the long discourses of the Buddha. They thought originally it was what was used to get converts, which kind of surprises me because we're non-proselytizing, but apparently back in the day there was some proselytizing. So that's the Digha Nikaya. The Majjhima Nikaya are the middle length discourses, and they go a little bit further into what people should know about the teachings. And then comes the Samyutta Nikaya, which explores these teachings in more depths. And Anguttara Nikaya are the numerical discourses. And then finally is the one we'll be talking about tonight, Kutta Nikaya, which is considered the oldest book of all. And inside the Kutta Nikaya is the Atthakavagga, which I'll be discussing tonight. The Atthakavagga was, they believe, scholars believe it was actually written, stated in the Buddha's time. When I say written, nothing was written, everything was memorized. But because of the way these verses are and their refrains and the Jain and Brahmin terminology they're using, they feel that these are really, really ancient. And they also don't sound like a lot of the Buddha's teachings. The Sutta Nipata is the sub-book that the Atthakavagga is found in. This was retranslated by my teacher, Gil Fronsdale, and he tried to keep the verse aspect of it. The original teachings, these really original ones, were all done in verse and were to be memorized. And they had wordplay in them, which is almost impossible to do back in English. Gil tried his best to do this and to keep the verse kind of quality going. And you can see if this was a place where you could not write anything down, you had to have mechanisms for memorizing it. And that was the reason for the verses. So in the Atthakavagga, there's two major themes. Actually, some scholars say there's four, but I'm going to take it down to two. Letting go of habitual behavior and letting go of opinions. The Atthakavagga has not been extensively quoted It's not something where you, I've taken Majjhima Nikaya courses and Digha Nikaya courses, never took an Atthakavagga course, never was offered. And it's because it leaves you to come up with your own take on it and whether even some of the things that are brought up are even possible. I'm going to, as one scholar said, it's premortal and it can be unsettling. So rather than a doctrine, it emphasizes how peace and equanimity are to be attained. It's not otherworldly. It addresses the problems of living here and now. So a lot of what came later is left out of this seed of the teachings. There's no mention of the Four Noble Truths, the Four Jhanas, the Five Aggregates, the Seven Factors of Awakening, all the lists that we've heard and we study and memorize. None of them are in the Atthakavagga. Some scholars actually question whether this is Buddhism at all. So this is from Professor Grace Burford. The type of Buddhism which is found in this short section of the Sutta Nipata differs very much from what is usually regarded as the earliest form of Buddhism, as it can be deduced from the first four Nikayas of the Pali Canon that I just told you, the Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, etc. The Atthakavagga represents the summum bonum as total desirelessness to be attained by the gradual elimination of desire and attachment, even attachment to the views of any particular teacher concerning the path to the goal. The goal is non-metaphysical and is obtainable in this life. There is no promise of a better rebirth after obtaining the goal or of an escape from the process of becoming. So that's different. You know, that's completely different than, you know, what we read in the rest of the Pali Canon. I read four translations and I read commentaries by K.R. Norman, who was someone who died but was a Pali scholar. I read Gill's book. Stephen Batchelor has a series of talks on Dharma Seed that you can listen to on the Atthakavagga. And then I read a commentary and translation by Thanissaro Bhikkhu. So from a completely secular Buddhist, you know, Stephen Batchelor, to Thanissaro Bhikkhu, who, you know, is a monk and very much agrees with rebirth and the teachings as they went through the five Nikayas. Some people think that it was written by different authors with different views and different audiences because of the paradoxical effect. According to K.R. Norman, we do not find a promise of immortality or deathless for the person who achieves the ideal, and the text contains no claim that the goal or the ideal person is either eternal or deathless. Since, in my opinion, these ideas are not part of Buddhism, my only surprise is that anyone should think that they are. So the Buddha himself was a product of his own society, and I think we tend to forget that. You know, he didn't come in a vacuum. He was part of Indian society, which had a definitive culture. And one of the most influential teachings at the time were the Upanishads, the Vedas. And I was surprised in my research, I got the impression he rejected the Upanishads completely. Well, he didn't. He didn't at all. And as Gill says in his commentary, many concepts that are now identified as Buddhist were already current in these early Vedic treatises. This is especially true of the case of the Upanishad of the Great Forest. This one talks about desirelessness, which the Buddha brings up over and over again. So I almost get the impression that there were plenty of things, plenty of ideas and reflections in the Upanishads that he agreed with, but he thought they were being taken to an extreme or weren't being interpreted correctly. Even surprisingly, the precepts, the five training precepts, are in the Upanishads. So much of Buddha's teachings originated from there with a different twist, a different interpretation. So it kind of reminds me perhaps of Martin Luther and the Catholic Church and his objection to the way that it was taken to such an extreme that you were losing the original message. It appears the Buddha might have been doing something similar regarding the interpretation of the Upanishads. So we're going to have the eight people read, and this is called, and I haven't pronounced this out loud either, and I've not heard anybody say it, so Dhutanataka Sutta. And if you would, just sit back, close your eyes, and listen to it, and see what you think. And Terry is the first paragraph.
Okay, so it's called the Eightfold Discourse on the Corrupt.
Why don't you stand up, Terry?
Yeah,
come up here and stand here so everybody can hear you. And so everybody, yeah.
Some dispute with their minds corrupt. Some dispute with truthful minds. Sages do not enter disputes that have arise, and so do not become despondent anywhere.
As one knows, so one speaks. How could one overcome one's views when led by desire, stuck in what's pleasing, and making up ideas of what's correct?
Of ignoble character, say the skillful ones, is someone who unasked boasts of oneself and of one's virtue and practices.
Of noble character, say the skillful ones, is a monastic at peace and fully stilled, who does not speak of one's own virtue or have any arrogance anywhere in the world.
Those who see personal advantage in tainted doctrines, they concoct, make up, and reverse, depend on an unstable peace.
It's not easy to overcome being entrenched in views, wishing to take up a doctrine. Such a person would adopt or reject a doctrine based on being entrenched.
Those who are cleansed do not form a view about states of becoming or non-becoming anywhere in the world. Having abandoned illusions and conceit, by what means would those who are cleansed go to non-attachment? They are without attachment.
One who is attached argues over doctrine. And how and with what does one argue with someone unattached, embracing nothing, rejecting nothing, right here. A person has shaken off every view.
So that's the end of it. I'll just pass these around. I don't think I have enough for everybody, but... So the can anybody see the paradox in this? How can you have no view and exist in the world? How is that possible? And yet that's what this verse, these poems are stating, to have no view and be at peace in the world. How is that possible?
Yeah. Well, it also takes the position that the best view is to have no view, so it's like it's kind of an internal contradiction.
Exactly. It's a complete paradox. The view is to have no view.
Right.
So it's almost like a koan of some kind that is impossible to answer. In the Atikavaga, this is what so many of these statements are like. Other poems go into other aspects of life, loneliness, solitude, and again, twist things around where you're not on stable ground. Yeah, Lynelle.
But isn't it the point a view or no view from the position of having the mind that has the view?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody told me a long time ago about disputing that you had to get off the battleground. You have to shift. Maybe it's like insight, only all the time. You know, where you're just not seeing things the same way. Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I'm not.
Well, you know, there is no answer. There's no answer provided. I've read so many commentaries and at least a few that are around, and there's different interpretations of what this could mean. They say it's very difficult. This is why you don't hear people getting up front talking about this, because what's to say? You know, well, let's all go home now, because... This has no grounding. There's no place to go with it.
It does keep referring to those who are cleansed. And so one would look, I imagine, further in that grouping of teachings to see how that's kind of defined. What do you do to be that? And you mentioned, you know, habitual... actions and
Habitual behavior and non-attachment are the two main themes in the Atikavaga.
I would think that would be the next place to look.
Well, purity is another topic that there's some verses on, which is what you're speaking of. In the Buddha's time, they also were having huge amounts of debates constantly about life, about philosophy, about everything. And in fact, there is a verse in here, it's called To Pursua, that I wanted to, which goes into some of these debates. Oh, I thought I marked it, and I don't think I did. Page 72. Lusting for debates and plunging into assemblies, they take each other to be fools. They speak relying on what others have said, passionate for praise, they call themselves skillful. Wishing for praise while debating in an assembly, they become anxious. Refuted, they become depressed, criticized and shaken. They seek their opponent's faults. This is one of another reading from the Atikavaga. So it appears, it's groundless, but it appears you can't ever win if you are in a debate. because the ego is involved. And when the ego is involved, there's going to be suffering. It does not say how you... Does that mean nobody ever takes a position on anything? You know, you just... I mean, it almost goes back to some of the points of view about Buddhist practitioners who get upset over nothing and just sit quietly in meditation and let the world go by. It almost seems like that. And if that's the case, as far as I'm concerned, that's not very helpful. Yeah, Yana.
It doesn't seem to me to exclude having right intention or having an intention. So you could have, you don't have to have a view, but you could still have an intention at the ground.
Okay, explain that a little bit more.
Well, if right intention is renunciation and intention for compassion and kindness, then if that's the ground that, like, a person's living from, mm-hmm. you don't need to have the view to, take part of that.
So, I agree with you. It seems to almost say go to experience. Go to what you need to do, and you don't need to be debating with anybody about it. Just do it. Is that what? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the impression I got too.
Diane.
Yeah.
Is not experience kind of the ultimate in terms of locating? I want to say an answer, or if something is going to work, it's not because I'm telling you. It's because you have to have your own experience of it.
Yeah, I think that's getting, that to me is satisfying.
Yeah.
And I agree with that and what Yana said, that, you know, having views is one thing, but actually being in the experience is something else. There's, I think I've talked about this before. There was studies done on climate change deniers and climate change proponents, and the more they argued, the further apart they became. And studies have found if you have taken up a view, means your ego is involved, and it means if somebody is going to come and challenge that view, you're going to become more constricted and more sure you're right. And according to the studies I've read, even if you're starting to doubt the view you're holding, as soon as someone challenges it, you're going to pull back and just grasp onto it some more, because it's your ego, it's self-identity. So when I was with Susan Orr doing the five precepts in climate change class, there was discussion on how to be with people, not argue with them, but how to be with people, kind of like what Jana and Judy are saying, that will change minds. And the way contemporary sociologists say is you find what you both agree upon. And in most cases, you agree that you love your family or your children or your grandchildren. And you start from there having a conversation. Not a viewpoint, but having a conversation. And I think that's what this is touching on as well. That experience rather than you're wrong, I'm right. So, and it's these original teachings, which is very interesting, were completely disregarded later on by Buddhists themselves. Orthodox Theravadan folks, monks and nuns, took on the two truths, and some people are going to make it into Nibbana, and some people aren't. And the people who are monastics, and the people who aren't are lay people. But you will get merit as long as you support the monastics, and maybe you'll be born again and be a monastic, then you might make it to Nibbana. You know.
Or only monastic men.
And only monastic men, right. So that became very problematic, and it certainly is nothing like these initial teachings at all. That's not there at all. And so what happened was when the Muslim invaders came into India and this very orthodox way of teaching was happening, well, it was very easy for them to either convert people or to have people go back to Brahmanism, which to them made more sense. And then the Mahayana folks came in, and they also rejected these early teachings and said, well, you Theravadan guys, you blew it. We've got the Bodhisattva ideal much better, and all your original teachings are crap. And they called it Hinayana, which is a pejorative term meaning inferior, the inferior wheel.
The lesser vehicle.
The lesser vehicle, that's right. Although that's a kind way of putting it. According to scholars, it means, you know, the inferior. And so, again, the original teachings are ignored. Holding on to a view, this is the way it is. We've got it together, you don't, caused a split in Buddhist practice. And then you can see it in every other, in the Muslim world. You know, the Sunni and Shia. So alike, yet slight differences, and clinging to that view, what has that done? Christian world. I mean, this is all over the place, and these core seed teachings go right to the heart of what can we do to live as human beings to avoid this. It seems to be in our nature, and the Buddha seemed to understand this, that we are constantly going to cling to a view, and you don't have that view, so I'm against you. And we're going to have all kinds of problems. I think he saw that. I think it is premortal. Another thing that I'm going to read this from Tanisaro Bhikkhu, and he talks about the paradox. Now, Tanisaro Bhikkhu is a monastic, believes... rebirth, everything. A certain amount of sensual pleasure is needed in the path to go beyond sensual pleasure. Right view is needed to go to overcome attachments to views. A regime of precepts and practices is needed to overcome attachment to precepts and practices. A strong sense of self-responsibility is needed to overcome attachment to doctrines of the self. Other passages in the Pali Canon offer clear analogies to explain these paradoxes, often in terms of movement toward a goal, taking a raft across a river, walking to a park, taking a series of relay coaches from one city to another, in which the motive and means of transport are abandoned on reaching the goal. The Adhikavaga, however, sometimes presents these paradoxes in as mystifying a manner as possible. In fact, some of the paradoxes, particularly in the discussions of abandoning clinging to views, are stated in terms so stark that on the surface they are hard to reconcile with teachings in the other Pali discourses or even with passages in the Adhikavaga itself. Well, you know, this is from a monk who said this is really difficult. And one of the things he said here, which I found really, really interesting because I've read it elsewhere, is the paradox also of the five training precepts. Now, what do I mean by that?
They're impossible.
Especially the first precept. For those of you who don't know the five training precepts, this is a basis for ethical behavior in Buddhist practice. And the first one is, I will not harm or kill living beings. Really? Really? That is an impossibility. Just by breathing, you're killing living beings. And the second was, I will not take anything that is not freely given. Third, I will not engage in sexual misconduct. And fourth is, I will always speak truthfully. And the fifth is, I won't take intoxicants to the point of heedlessness. Well, I think we're all breaking those all the time. So there's the paradox. Mm-hmm. So why have them? Mm-hmm. Because it's a way of being. It might not ever be fulfilled completely, but it is a way of being. It is a paradox. And it gets to the point where if you have been practicing and you have made these teachings so much a part of you, you don't even have to think in terms of precepts. In each situation, you will know what to do because of your wisdom practice and your heart practice. That, to me, is a paradox. To actually know deeply what you need to do, which might not be the first precept. And I can't give an example right now, but I'm sure there's many of them where somebody had to do something which they knew was not fulfilling the first precept, but for the greater good, that's what needed to be done. And in that moment, that's all that matters, how much harm is going to be caused. And so that's the paradox also of clinging to this view that this sutta talks about. How willing are you to let it go? How willing are you? That's a hard one. You stop and think about the views that you're holding, and how willing are you to, for the greater good, I'm not going there. Well, your chance to practice is coming up in a week. And you should. You should look at that. How can I practice? You know, in prison, I've had a couple guys come up and say, I'm so taken with this practice. I like it so much. I feel I've changed so much. I'm really feeling like I'm a better person now. I want to help you convert others. I want others to start doing this. How do I do that? What do you think the answer is? Anybody, what do you think? Yeah.
I think you do it by that deep, by how you live. You don't
That's
do
right.
it by telling
That's exactly right.
Lecture.
That's exactly right. Lecturing, there's a view. What's going to happen to that person that you're going to say, hey, you need to do this. What you're doing, that doesn't work. Try this. This works. Is that going to be helpful? No. No, but just by being a person of integrity and compassion and acting that way in the world without a view, that might work. Those are the kind of people you want to hang around with, that you want to be, that are not lecturing you, but just their way of being is plenty. It's what you want. You want that too. I've told this story many years ago. When I first started going into prison, I had a service canceled, so I got to spend time with two clerks. One was a Muslim clerk, one was a Christian clerk. And just making conversation, I said, is there anybody in this prison, an inmate that everybody likes, everybody admires? This was at Old Folsom, the Johnny Cash prison. And they both mentioned the same person. And I said, well, what is it about him? Is he a teacher? Is he a Christian? Is he a Muslim? We don't know what he is. It doesn't say that. But he's always honest, and if you ask him something, no matter what he tells you, you know he's just telling you to be honest and not wanting to hurt you. So everybody goes to him for advice. He's called independent. I thought that was very interesting. And I think that I think of that person who I've never met and never spoke about it with these clerks again, but I think that's what this passage is saying as well. Not clinging to a view, being independent, being your own person, and your message is your way of being in the world. I think that's what this is saying, what it's extolling. Yeah, Judy?
Apart from using the paradoxes as a way to deal with an issue, is there anything that represents mystery in Buddhism? Not understanding, but, oh, I know in Christianity there's lots of mystery, but I've not heard that kind of feeling or teaching on, oh, we can't answer that because that's all mystery. But somehow it gets dealt with through, like you're saying, experience or paradox or whatever.
There's a series of questions the Buddha refuses to answer. And when Ananda, his chief attendant, asked him why he wouldn't answer, and he said, no matter how I answered, it would be taken a certain way. It's a view. It would not be heard for what it is. So things like rebirth, where does a Buddha go after he dies? I mean, these were a series of questions that this Brahmin youth asked the Buddha. And he would just sit there and say absolutely nothing. So I guess that's the mystery. My own interpretation is there are some things I think with our limited minds, with the way we think, with holding our own views, we would not even begin to understand. We'd interpret it according to our own culture or experience, whatever. We can't help it. And so he would make no comment. I think in deep, deep meditation, maybe there's some of that that happens that is beyond words. And maybe that's what non-answering is pointing to. Bob?
Yeah, I'm just sitting here thinking how you could easily take this no-view thing too far and have your ego all attached into being, well, I'm not the kind of person who participates in, you know, debates. Does that believe me? Because these people are disputing views, and I don't do that, I'm better than that. I mean, you could easily make that into just another ego thing. And I don't see, like you said earlier, I don't say you can kind of live in the world without having views. I mean, even, we're choosing to come to a Buddhist group instead of, you know, an Islamic group or some other group, presumably because we have a view that this path works better for us, or is a path to freedom and other things. So you can't really do it. But the insight seems very valid, that if you get in these arguments, you just create all this alienation, and it's not good. It creates suffering, but I don't think you can really, the no-view thing can't really be done. You're constantly having views, I think.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what Thanissaro Bhikkhu was saying, too. You almost have to have a view to drop a view. It's a paradox. And, I totally agree with you. It's not easy, you know. Teaching is not easy.
Yeah. But it seems like a lot of this is saying that instead of participating in debate and in that, there's better things to do. And I'm always thinking with this practice that the better thing to do is to work on yourself, to be with yourself, and to try to understand. And people don't want to do that. They want to tell somebody else what to do, and
that's
I think maybe the biggest message
message that I get out of this is that quit spending your time in something that's not doable and spend your time with what can change.
Yeah. It's a great great analysis of it. I like that. Yeah, Dave.
I'm not. I've been kind of reflecting on this state of mind that might exist without views, and I'm not so sure that it's that far from our normal experience. I think at least many of us, I think, go home and in the quiet of night think to ourselves, boy, this is a lot of nonsense, you know. my own opinions, wow, how could I really think that? Why did I say that thing at work, or why do I really think this way about this politician, or I really care? But when we're in the marketplace of ideas, when we go to work, or when we, the prisoner who said, well, what do I do with this wisdom that I've uncovered in myself?
Right.
He suddenly has to speak. And when we speak incorrectly, and we speak with views that we may or may not really, in our heart of hearts,
right,
abide by.
Right. It goes back to self-identity again. It's been my view, so that's
but I think
me.
But I think maybe there's this underlying kind of experience at the end of the day that really isn't as committed to these views and concepts as we tend to think we are.
Yeah. You know, later in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha extrapolates on this a little bit more. He says, a proponent of the Dharma disputes with no one in the world. So it's kind of saying the same thing. Doesn't say a view, but it's talking about disputing with anybody. And I think what Dave is saying is really valid. When we start looking at our views, why are we holding half the views that we're holding? I mean, what's the reason behind them? Was it just something we inherited or born with, or I'm a male or female, or I'm a certain race, or I'm this or that? You know, how much validity is there in my particular view? When you start questioning that, I think it's getting closer to this groundlessness that this sutta is talking about. Linnell, then Linda.
This is really short. I was captivated by a greeting card when I was about 20 that said, do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. And it was by the fourth Zen patriarch. And at that time I was not practicing or anything like that, and I have carried that card with me. It's still up in my bathroom because I realized at the time I didn't understand it, but it hit me somewhere.
Yes, yes.
And it's really that same kind of idea that you don't know what the truth actually is. And to walk around saying, I know this, I know that, I know, that's all opinion.
That's right. Yep.
And as soon as you can sort of start to drop, I guess now that I've been practicing longer, I get glimmers. When you can drop that and you can speak in a more natural way, because, I mean, I worked in the business world for such a long time, and it's posturing and protection and jockeying back and forth and doing all that. But, you know, there's even a way to start to approach that from understanding being on the inside of yourself as well. But it's tricky, and I think that's what this feels, just like what you were saying, that's what this feels like, is speaking to.
I agree.
Yeah.
It's like, what's left when all of those opinions are gone?
That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
An empty sheet.
Yeah, what's left?
Okay. Yeah, Bob, then Linda.
Well, you can't have to go ahead.
Okay, Linda. Sorry.
So this is making me, honestly, I cannot read this without thinking about Facebook. Some of you are my Facebook friends, including you.
Thinking about what?
Facebook. And Facebook is a place that is full of views. Yeah. And I don't go on it all that much because I get lost in all the time it takes. But I was thinking about how I do tend to post things that express views, political views. And my hope in doing that is that I'm putting something out that some others may read, and that will be helpful in because I get the New York Times, so I can put these New York Times things in that most people probably aren't getting. And it seems to me that it's okay to express a view, but not to be aggressive and hostile in the way that one introduces that view. And as you're saying about the prisoner, to be honest, but not in a battle about it. Not that I don't have that inclination to get in a battle about it, but I really try to ask a question, for example, so that maybe people are provoked to think about it. Because to go, you know, I'm questioning, right here a person has shaken off every view. Well, as you're saying, doesn't that introduce the possibility that we become merely passive observers of everything going on, and those who are more willing to dispute take over, which often seems to perhaps be happening. So I'm thinking that we have, that it's important to have views that express values that are hopefully based on justice and compassion and caring, but not to be aggressive in the way we present those views. Does that seem to fit with what is being said here?
There's no answer. It's causing you to think. Mm-hmm. I think that's all it's meant to do, is really start looking and how do you interpret this. It is a koan. Mm-hmm. That's your interpretation. There's no right or wrong. Isn't that uncomfortable?
Yes. Uncomfortable. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why these are not taught that much.
But I think if you can express your view but not be attached to the outcome, mm-hmm. then maybe that's the idea.
Could be.
That's a step.
Could be. All right. Bob, and then Karen, and then we'll finish up.
Yeah, well, I would feel like something similar. To me, it's more like it's that icky sense of clinging to a particular opinion that is... that causes suffering, but you can't. I mean, every move you make during the day expresses a view. Like if you decide mm-hmm. to come to sim rather than watch television, you've got some underlying view. Then, well, that's a better use of my time. Or when you wake up in the morning, it's like, well, I will have instead of having a sugar for breakfast, I'll have something that's healthier because I have a view that I'm going to feel better. But if either of those things are all have all this, you know, negative, clinging, weird energy attached to that, they're not going to feel good. But the views themselves don't seem to be so much of a problem because you can't act in the world without
mm-hmm.
them.
Well, my own opinion, I think going back to what Jana said and what Judy said, it's more doing what you believe is right rather than speaking about it and trying to convince someone else that what you're doing is right.
Yeah, but even if you're not telling anyone, if you're beating yourself up internally about, you know, your superego about, oh, I have to do this because I blah blah. I mean, that's not so good either. That's clinging to views.
Yep, that's a view.
That's right.
All right, Karen.
I think whoever said about letting go of results, which is really hard to do. When I first started doing climate
were the first meditation teacher I ever had. I was talking to him about it, and he said, I'm going to give you a sentence that I want you to meditate on every day, and it is abandon all hope for results.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been really helpful, and it has helped me when I, you know, go with groups to the state legislature to lobby on climate bills and stuff, and I, you know, and I try to focus on finding common ground and on, you know, hearing as well as being heard, and then I like. On one level, a result, because I'm very concerned about what's happening in the world, but I'm also understanding more and more that the more I get hung up on needing the result, the more potential I have to be just obnoxious about it. That's not go there at all.
That's right. That's it. I totally agree with you. All right. So it is 1 minute after 9. Do a final dedication of merit from the evening. May this evening cause you to look at the views that you hold and also look at the views other people hold with kindness, with understanding, with compassion, and especially as Thanksgiving is coming. And may the merit of your understanding and your wise heart be felt by your family, your friends, by all living beings. May your tolerance and kindness ripple out to affect every sentient being. And may all of us be free of greed, hatred, and delusion in this lifetime. Coming and for your wisdom. I really appreciate it.